There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Greetings, poetry lovers. In this, our series, Be Like the Corman, celebrating the works of the late Roger Corman, we turn once again to Corman's treatment of one of his favorite authorial sources, Mr. Edgar Allan Poe. The Raven is his interpretation of Poe's most famous poem, so in honor of that, I would like to present you with a lesser-known work of Poe's that, if you pay attention, can be considered a somewhat semi-autobiographical. See if you can pick up on the subtext. And this is not known. This is one of the very few he actually set to music. I'm not going to be able to do it justice, but... I'm Edgar Allan Poe, I am, Edgar Allan Poe, I am, I am. I got married to my cousin, Miss Clem. She was just 13 back then, and then I wrote a bunch of scary books. With poetry, I'm really quite a ham. I was born in Boston, died in Baltimore. Edgar Allan Poe, I am, I am. Edgar Allan Poe, I am. And I will spare you the following 35 verses. They're just too emotionally overwhelming.
You totally made that up.
No, I'll never.
Just because you're still trying to get people to listen to the idea of having a musical called Poe with an exclamation point, aren't you?
I will be recognized someday. It may only come posthumously, but my vision will be made real.
Yeah, the assassin will find your picture in his wallet.
I am your host, Max, minor flesh wounds in the room morgue, Levine. And over there, being slowly bricked up in a wall with a cask of Diet Dr. Pepper, is your host, Mike, for the love of Bumpy Montresor Luce. Give us a taste of the macabre, Mike.
It smelled like Amontillado.
You don't even know what Amontillado smells like.
Yes, I do.
You never.
It does. I mean, I do. I mean...
Before we get over to our casks of Amontillado, which we may need to get through this movie, we have our poll question.
Poll question.
Last time we asked you, what genre do you think mixes best with comedy? Degsy O'Brien took time out from his landscape painting and mystery solving to tell us, comedy and horror, for me, both have many things in common. A desire to trigger reactions in their audiences at the visceral level, whether it's screams or laughs. An ability to break societal convention, whether it's Jason slicing through camp counselors with his machete or Groucho Marx slicing through high society with his barbed one-liners. Nice. And a willingness to break taboos and court controversy, whether it's with the extreme gore of Day of the Dead or the liberal use of the N-bomb in Blazing Saddles. When it's done right, a horror comedy is a sublime combination, whereas sci-fi and drama have far too many variations to them to ensure more successful mixes. Very cool. Thanks, Daisy.
Neat.
Steve Kellner, excuse me, Dr. Steve Kellner, Dr. Steve Kellner.
Don't be mean. Just because you're not a doctor.
I play one on TV.
No, you don't.
I could.
No, you couldn't.
Stat, give me 20 cc's of that thing over there.
I need a sedative.
Sedative? Anyway, Steve Kellner says, I'm not sure this is answerable since so much comedy is satire of genre. It's a fair point. For example, Blazing Saddles, Airplane, Young Frankenstein all had radically different genres in mind. True. Another doctor, Dr. Professor Rebecca Pelkey, says, I think musicals pair well with comedy. Singing in the Rain, Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, The Muppet Movie. That's a great trio. I mean, talk about three utterly unconnected musicals. That's great. Nick Hoffman says, I'm going with horror on this one, as Young Frankenstein is, in my estimation, as close to perfection as it gets. Okay, that works.
Max hates Mel Brooks. Hates Peter Pan.
Oh, yeah. What's he going around being all funny for? Adam Mark says, I don't have a definitive answer for that. That's fair. Comedy is a necessary element of any film, whether it be overt or subtle. It really depends on the elements of the plot, the dialogue, tone, and players. I think the most plentiful and successful examples are found in dramas, dramedies, rom-coms, novels of manners, etc. Think of the film depictions of Jane Austen, Edith Wharton, Oscar Wilde, Henry James... Henry James, really? Those movies are funny?
Is he Room with a View? No.
You know, I don't remember. I don't think so.
I know what he's talking about. It's that type of movie.
Yeah. Noel Coward, Eugene O'Neill, right up to Terrence McNally, Tony Kushner, Aaron Sorkin, and Darren Star. Dramas, great dramas, all caps, infused with funny and witty characters, snappy dialogue, all of which helps us to see the absurdities of life and society while we still cheer on the star-crossed romance or whatever in front of us. Without comedy, which can include even just the hint of a joke, like our show, dramas become soul-crushing, morose exercises where people just shout at each other for an hour or so. Would Terms of Endearment work without Aurora's foibles? Would Steel Magnolias work without Clary and Ussier? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's misspelled. Or
Ussier. I think it's a French Ussier. Name. It's French Ussier's, for Ussier.
Ah, Ussier's frenemy banter. Would A Few Good Men work without Sorkin's wicked wit? Does Four Weddings and a Funeral work without the eulogy at Gareth's funeral cracking a joke at his strange cooking experiments? Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? I'm sorry, that was me. Argue no. With horror
the
fantasies.
Germans didn't bomb Pearl Harbor.
It's a line from Animal House.
Okay.
When the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? The Germans? Shut up, he's on a roll. With horror, fantasy, sci-fi, I think it's harder for comedy to succeed since comedy can be so context-specific. The Mel Brooks examples use sci-fi, horror, and fantasy tropes, but they parody those genres. They are comedies first, using these genres' tropes, not contributing to the genres truly. Ooh, interesting distinction.
Mm.
A true comedy horror is, really, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer, which plays it straight.
Ah.
Okay. Anyways, dramas and comedies are as intertwined as the comedy sorrow masks of theater. It's the yin and the yang of the stage, indeed the human experience.
Hmm.
Wow. Heavy stuff. Good stuff. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, don't know if I'll agree with the Abraham Lincoln one, though.
I hear that was pretty funny. I just don't think it meant to be. Val Coons, supreme naughty dominatrix of Q footsteps and wearer of high stiletto boots and riding crops. Oh,
Pikachu will teach you respect. Sorry, that's a personal deeper.
Yes. Okay. I think they all work as long as the acting is sincere. By that, I mean that the actors are taking their roles seriously and committing to them as opposed to going for laughs. When they're caught in ridiculous situations or saying double entendres, their sincerity is what makes the scene hilarious. Think Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther movies, for instance. That being said, I think it's easier to play straight in a genre that's already out there like sci-fi or horror.
Hmm.
Okay, that works.
Neat.
Tyler Stewart says, I always thought horror and comedy were the ideal contrasting genres, but then there's The Princess Bride.
He always comes good back point. To Princess. It's like Brian and going back to Fifth Element.
Charles Forsythe.
I struggle with that one every week.
Jeff Dunham.
What? Just read it.
Charles Forsythe says, by volume, the answer would be romance. I think there are more romantic comedies than any other X-comedy genre. I remember X-comedy. That was a great title that John Byrne
He meant fill in the blank.
Oh.
Like your brain.
That's going to need a lot to fill that in.
That's for sure.
Best, I think comedy mixes with other genres best when it creates satire or parody. To the extent that Love at First Bite, episode 273, thank you, Charles, is enjoyable. He cites the number. Way to go, Charles.
Wow.
Is enjoyable. It's that it riffs on established expectations of vampire movies. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Imagine taking a movie which is neither social commentary nor a derivative of an established story and throw in comedy. It does not work. Ooh, boy, that's controversial. Like, what if instead of Clarice Starling's Silence of the Lambs featured Inspector Clouseau? It would have been I still would have watched it. It would have been a jarring mess of clashing tones. Oh, wow.
What are these his name just do?
The lambs they were screaming? That's just making fun of the accent. You'd spend the whole runtime marveling at how the writer and director had no understanding of how jarring tonal shifts pull the audience out of the narrative. You'd be like, did George Lucas direct this? Okay, that's, totally fair.
Would you like some ice cream?
So So you just can't mix comedy into another genre unless there is some underlying commentary being made via satire or parody. Interesting.
Huh.
Huh. I'd have to think about that. Yeah. I don't know if I agree, but I hadn't come at it that direction.
Well, we'll just get to the end and I'll talk about the question. Yeah. But.
And finally, from that funniest of countries and funniest of continents, the continent of Canada.
You just say Canada.
I know, just the word is funny, you know? Vince says, I feel that animation is the best genre for comedy, if animation is considered a genre.
No.
Oh, wow. Well, it's a medium, but yes. It allows for more extreme physicality and situations that comedies often trade in, and I think more outrageous elements are much easier to accept and take in with animated films. Sometimes horror and comedy go well, but for me, only if the comedy is secondary to the horror and used as a relief or a way to make the horror more surprising. Well, thanks, Vince.
Yeah.
Interesting. These were all very cool. What about you? What do you think? What genre mixes best with comedy for you?
I honestly do really like the mix of horror and comedy when it's done such that it's, as opposed to the parody of like Love at First Bite, where it's like, oh no, it's all funny, there's no danger. When you get films like Evil Dead 2, Evil Dead 1's okay, and Evil Dead 2, to be fair, is just a remake of Evil Dead 1, but better, or Return of the Living Dead, the horror is still there. And your characters are still getting killed off, but the humor is, it's not even opposed to it. It's just you're finding humor in these very dark, otherwise horribly scary things.
So like American Werewolf in London.
Right.
And where people still are being killed. It's still horrifying, but, you know, hi, David!
Especially with him looking like he's just been run over by a truck. So I like when it's done properly, even if it's parody, there are sometimes some amazing examples. What We Do in the Shadows, see our entire episode on What We Do in the Shadows, is because there's still like, there's scenes where I remember one episode, this is the original version, where one of the vampires is inviting this young couple over totally just to eat them. Like, that's going to be what's going to happen. Yeah. And I think he does, as a matter of fact, but they don't leave it out, but it's still funny somehow. And if you can manage to do that, that takes a lot of skill.
Okay.
When I asked the question, obviously it was based on the movie we were watching last week, which was supposed to be a mix of humor and horror.
Yeah.
It didn't really have either of those elements in
it. Not really.
But I didn't really expect people to take it quite the way they did, and I'm really glad I asked it. It was actually one of those questions like, I wonder if this is going to get many answers or not, but there's at least three of them that were like, well, blah blah blah, let's talk about how this works, doesn't work, that I thought were really interesting. So I'm really glad y'all came up with something better than my initial. But speaking of coming up with something, Max, what's your favorite mix of comedy and something?
I honestly can't answer that. I think comedy works in any genre where it works. I think comedy, comedy is a genre in and of itself, and it can use the trappings of others, but I think it can work with anything. War movies, horror movies, science fiction, fantasy.
Jerry Lewis.
Well, there are limits, but yeah, no. Jerry Lewis.
See our entire episode on whatever that Jerry Lewis film was.
Oh Lord! Now I've forgotten.
Well,
it was one of those Martin
go.
And Lewis movies, and yeah, that should tell you something of what we thought about it.
Yeah,
but I really liked everybody's answer. Some of that was really fascinating, and actually gives me something to think about.
Yeah,
but those were terrific, and so we want more of them because you're just too darn good at this.
Yeah.
So my question, sort of brought on by this week's movie, is which author's works do you most enjoy seeing adapted into film?
Oh, neat.
No, who's your favorite? I can't say film author because that doesn't mean anything. So, what author's adaptations?
Why do I have a feeling that one of our listeners is going to choose The Princess Bride?
It could be William Goldman. Hey, William Goldman has a hell of a track record.
Yeah, but has he had any other books adapted?
Sure, Stepford Wives.
Oh, that's him?
That's him. Oh. Marathon Man.
Oh, weird.
Oh, yeah, those are the big ones that I can think of.
Huh.
I think there have been others.
Cool. Well, how could they tell us their answers, Max? You must tell me right now.
No, but want it too much.
No, please, tell me how. Tell me how. Somehow I've forgotten over 295 episodes.
No, we will tell you at the end of the show. I'll break the suspense. But before that...
The facts.
Budget. This is one of those Corman budgets where there isn't a lot of agreement, but it was most likely somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000.
Yeah.
Most of which, by the way, went to the salaries
yep.
of the big names, Peter Lorre, Boris Karloff, and Vincent Price.
Mm.
So they took the lion's share. The box office take, $1.5
million. Wow.
This was Corman's most successful film in terms of budget to take.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. This was very popular. If you notice this, it was written by, now, it's a bit much. They give Edgar Allan Poe a screenwriting credit, which is, I guess, fair, but also kind of mean.
Well, sure. There's a raven in it.
There is a raven. We'll get to that. But it was also written by Richard I. M. Legend Matheson, who did a couple of scripts for Corman. The movie itself was shot in 15 days.
That many.
Yeah, it's hey, that's compared to Little Shop, which was shot in two, this was an epic.
Well, Bucket of Blood was five.
Mm-hmm. Peter Lorre and Jack Nicholson were big ad-libbers. They liked to add up on, I've got a list of some of them, which really annoyed Boris Karloff, who was a consummate professional and really wanted to work off the script. Vincent Price didn't like it either, but he adapted to it pretty well. Karloff never did.
Mm.
Several of Peter Lorre's best lines are ad-libbed, including, "How the hell should I know?"
When that was a brilliant Peter Lorre.
Thank you. And so they're down in the crypt here. Hard place to keep clean, huh? And it's retrieving the dead man's hair in the family chapel, because that's where Lenore is. Yeah, where else? Jack Nicholson gave high praise to everyone he worked with on the set, except one. The Raven itself. He said, the Raven pooped on everyone, but especially liked to poop on him. He later said, I would look down when the Raven flew off my shoulder and it would be covered in poop. I hated that bird. When Dr. Adolphus Bedloe, Peter Lorre, is casting his spells, he uses a bunch of Latin phrases. To be fair, they are real Latin phrases, but like veni, vidi, vici, I came, I saw, I conquered. De mortuis nil nisi bonum, do not speak ill of the dead. Cave canem, beware of the dog. Civis pacem parabellum, if you want peace, prepare for war. That was a Caesar quote.
Mm.
Ceterum censeo Carthaginem esse defendam. Furthermore, I believe that Carthage must be destroyed.
What about yep. Expelliarmus? Isn't that in there somewhere?
To be fair, hey, he used real Latin, not that Potter-esque fake Latin.
Oculus Reparo.
Oh, God.
Roseanne Flotar.
That's closer. Size of a million bees. Roger Corman and Richard Matheson enjoyed making the comic part of The Black Cat, which was an episode for Tales of Terror, and they wanted to do an entirely comic Poe feature.
I see.
The tension between Peter Lorre and Jack Nicholson as father and son, according to Corman, that didn't come from the script. Those two hated each other. They really didn't get along.
Oh.
Vincent Price has this memory of the duel. Boris hated being struck up in the air on those chairs. He was terribly crippled, and we were both floating in the air on these wires. It wasn't a pleasant feeling. And I hated having that snake wrapped around my neck for 2 hours. I hate snakes.
Brilliant.
It's like he was here in the studio, wasn't it? By the way, if the burning interior of the castle looked at all familiar,
what?
It was in fact reused from The House of Usher. See our episode on the fall of the House of Usher.
Where I in fact mentioned that.
Yep. Actress Hazel Court, who played Lenore, said, all I remember of Jack Nicholson is that he used to say, oh, I must go home and write tonight. I don't know what he wrote, but he always saying he was going to write.
Oh, we may find out.
Yeah. Boris Karloff is also in the 1935 version of The Raven. Not as funny.
Ah. Well, we'll talk about that too.
With the exception of the previous year's Tales of Terror, which had Vincent Price, Peter Lorre, Deborah Padgett, and Basil Rathbone, this was the next closest thing that Roger Corman ever came to having an all-star cast. It also, as I say, was one of his biggest box office hits. The voice of Grimes, Craven's servant, you can tell, is obviously looped.
What?
Yeah, it's done by another Corman regular, Leo Gordon. Presumably, and no one will confirm this, William Baskin's voice just wasn't threatening enough. No. The LA Times announced that Jim Jr., who is the Raven from the title role, was nominated for a Patsy Award along with several other animal actors. Well pooped, Jimmy.
Junior.
By the way, and I checked on this. This is true. Vincent Price, as the sorcerer Dr. Erasmus Craven, inspired the creation of Doctor Strange from Marvel Comics.
Really?
He was, in fact, Steve Ditko's model for the Sorcerer Supreme. Stephen Strange's full name is Stephen Vincent Strange.
Huh.
In Price's honor.
Hmm.
Yep. When this film was completed ahead of schedule, 15 days, he decided, Corman said, well, we're here anyway, let's make another movie, and they made The Terror. Same sets, most of the same cast.
Yeah, well, that's our Roger.
If you are curious about when the movie is set, because that's a critical point, it takes place around 1506. You can tell by the coffin we see Erasmus's father.
What? No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it says he'd been dead for 20 years, and the death date on the coffin is 1486.
There is nothing 16th century about this movie at all.
They have hats. They have funny hats. And they live in castles. In the 16th century, everybody lived in castles. It's true.
Yeah, Max knew because he was there.
I was there. I lived in a castle, too.
Yeah, you're going to live in a box.
People thought it was a refrigerator box, but it was a castle.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be.
The cinematographer for this was Floyd Crosby.
Oh, again?
The father of rock legend David Crosby.
Really?
And the man behind the camera on a lot of other American international movies.
Hmm.
He actually won an Academy Award in 1931 for Murnau's Taboo, A Tale of the South Seas.
Only 33 years before this film.
Yep. Hazel Court said in an interview later that she was really annoyed when the film came out because the critics kept talking about her breasts rather than her acting.
Well?
In one Time magazine critic wrote, the sexy, lusty redhead is played by the English actress Miss Hazel Court, in whose cleavage you could sink the entire works of Edgar Allan Poe, plus a bottle of his favorite booze.
I mean, they are kind of out there.
They are rather prominent, but still,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah, that's very rude.
Guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, critics... I mean, that says a lot about the critic now, doesn't it? So there, that's where we're going to lay that.
It does. That's pretty much all I've got. Have you got anything?
No.
Okay.
I mean, yes, the barn fire. We've seen this before. Also, yeah. I got to say, when we first see a picture of the house or the castle, it's like, well, seen that before.
Yeah.
Gee, this coastline seems familiar.
Yeah, when you see the lightning flash behind Scarabus's castle, yeah. All I could think is, this looks rather Gilligan-esque.
Well, either that or Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you?
Yeah. Bats should have started flying out of the windows.
Well, then we do get a bat. It's plastic, but we can
sort of
get one.
We'll get to that.
Yeah,
we'll
get to
the effects. So, but now, the story.
Well, everyone knows the plot of the poem.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about a man who's just sort of depressed, and a bird flies in and basically confronts the idea that he is never going to get over his lost love. And that's what this... You don't have to do this, Max, because that's totally what the movie's about, too, right?
Oh, yeah. That's what I have. The plot is very straightforward. It's a faithful adaptation of Poe's poem, The Raven.
We're lying.
In that there is indeed a raven in it.
Yes.
There is also a woman named Lenore.
Yep.
And Vincent Price does actually quote a couple of lines from the poem. And, of course, who can forget Poe's beautifully stylized account of a nighttime coach ride and, of course, his wizard's duel, which is so beautifully rendered. Wait, what? Okay, so there's virtually no similarity between the movie and the poem.
No.
All the action in the poem involves a bird sitting on the bust of someone's head and saying one word over and over again.
Yeah.
Not even Corman could have made money on that, although he might have tried. The movie takes place in the early 16th century, Mike.
No, it doesn't.
Somewhere in the country of
California.
Europe. And it involves the grieving widower and magician Erasmus Craven, who has lost both his first wife, the mother of his beloved daughter Estelle, and his second wife, Lenore, and that's just careless losing two wives in a row, who apparently passed away due to death, I guess. One evening, Erasmus's life is thrown into turmoil when a raven shows up to start haranguing him. But this is no ordinary raven. Oh, no. It's an enchanted Peter Lorre. I mean, Adolphus Bedloe. Dr. Adolphus Bedloe. Once turned back to his human form, Bedloe lets slip that he has seen Erasmus's allegedly dead wife in the house of the man who turned Bedloe into a raven. The spooky Dr. Scarabus, who is so evil that he doesn't have a first name. Erasmus immediately sets out to see if there's any truth to this story, along with Bedloe, Estelle, and Bedloe's apparently brain-damaged son, played by Corman favorite Jack Nicholson. Once there, Scarabus proves to be a charming host, inviting them to dinner and casually destroying a drunken Bedloe who challenges his magic. Whoopsie! But holy Admiral Akbar, it's a trap! Bedloe is working with Scarabus. Scarabus wants Craven's magical secrets, like how he can cast spells without props, which Scarabus can already do, so I don't know why he wants this. Scarabus threatens to torture Estelle. Bedloe changes sides again, and things can only be settled by a wizard's duel. So magic, very sorcery. Who will win? Who will be destroyed? Who can tell you these things? Well, us, actually, so let's do so.
The film.
So, Max, you saw this when you were a child and loved it.
I did. It was the first time I'd ever seen, like, a wizard's duel live action on TV.
Well, you know, there's a very interesting point about that. Did this wizard duel remind you of any other wizard duel?
I kept waiting for someone to scream, you know, Avada Kedavra!
No!
Oh, what?
I turn into a hippopotamus. I turn into a germ.
Sword in the Stone.
Which, yeah, as it turns out, would show up almost a year after this film.
Oh.
I looked it up.
Interesting.
That's what reminded me, that this reminded me of.
So, just for those of you who haven't seen The Sword in the Stone, that's the duel between Merlin and Mad Madam Mim.
Yeah. The most magical part of that film is when the young Arthur's voice keeps changing.
Yeah. So, when it's time to change.
Yeah, he kind of Peter Brady's all the way through that film.
Yeah.
So you saw this when you were a kid. You trusted as a mother.
Did.
have you seen it since?
I have not.
Okay, so just for the show. Yep. Did it turn out that you actually remembered most of it, or?
I remembered big chunks of it. Mm. There was a lot I'd forgot.
Yeah. Which is strange for an hour and 25 minutes.
Yeah.
26. Sorry. So, we have some actors to talk about. What you think?
Yes, we do. Vincent Price. Yes. I gotta say, for someone who's usually playing menacing or frightening characters, he's a pretty good milksop.
Sure.
Although he goes from milksop to badass awfully quickly.
He's also, what's the word I want? Towering over everybody else.
Yeah, he's approximately 11 feet tall. Did you know that? I watching this movie, apparently they got a lot of short actors. I mean, Peter Lorre's 5'3", and Boris Karloff, I think, is 5'4", 5' at this point.
Well, at this point, of course, you're sitting there looking at him going, so, that was Frankenstein's monster, huh? Must have worn some... Well, of course, he did. The boots he wore had giant blocks under them, but...
Also, he was in bad shape at this point. He died the next year.
Oh, poor Boris.
Yeah.
Luckily, he had just enough time to do the voiceover for The Grinch.
Yep. Which is a great legacy to have.
Yeah. Vincent, I think, is fine. I don't think this is Vincent's best performance by a long shot.
No.
I think he can soften himself up, and he does seem sort of, you know, a little hopeless, a little lost, which is what the character needed to do, and he goes along with everything. Oh, everyone's nice. Let's be nice to people. Isn't it nice to be nice to the nice? Okay. And it's fine. I don't actually mind him becoming the badass, because it you could make the argument that he's the kind of guy who is searching for knowledge and power just because he's interested in it, as opposed to actually wanting to use it. And in that way, it makes his character a little bit better. But I think I'm also granting quite a huge license where one wasn't even applied for. So he's fine.
Yeah. Peter Lorre, what'd you think of him?
I want to say that if you're looking for the subtlety of Maltese Falcon or maybe the depth of Casablanca, you should go back and look there. He seemed a lot like he couldn't remember his lines.
Well, he was improvising a lot of it.
Yeah, which sometimes people do because they can't remember.
They can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's fine.
He's trying. I mean.
Yeah.
Honestly, the main thing with the character is he's so grating.
Yeah.
And he's so annoying. I'm like, why are you helping this guy? You know, just pluck him and you'll have a raven stew tomorrow.
Well, you know, I don't even mind, you know, him voicing over the raven because whatever. I can only guess that it was really, really hot. And that's why the raven's mouth was open all the time, because I think that that's how they shed heat. I don't know that, but I think so. He's fine. His eyes are bugging out pretty good. And he's not at the height of his career, but he's fine, I guess.
He has a couple of funny lines. You know, if I had been sober, which I admit rarely happens.
Yeah. Well, you kind of crossed Peter Lorre and Vincent Price there.
Well, it's hard. I just, you know, doing one or the other.
Yeah.
So I mean, they're both Hungarian Jews.
So what did you think of Peter Lorre?
I think he was all right. He was trying, but he seems kind of tired in this. Mm. And like I say, he leans way too hard into the be annoying as opposed to like endearingly bumbling.
Yeah.
And honestly, the relationship with the son, the way he reacts apparently because he didn't like Nicholson, is really kind of disturbing. And how quick he's like, I want to ditch your mother. I don't like you.
There were some interesting directorial choices there.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But Boris, what do we think of Boris?
Boris, every time when he was walking down the stairs, I'm like, oh God, somebody's going to catch him, right? He did not look well. But I liked him. I think he's the best thing in this. Because he's never like, even when he's showing that he's really being evil, it's kind of still endearing.
You know what it kind of reminds me of in a vague way? It reminds me when all the Ents have chopped down the walls of Orthanc and they've filled the entire valley with water, and they come up to talk to Saruman and they're like, you need to come down. And he's like, oh, my friends, it's so nice to see you. And wouldn't you like, we could come up, you know, just you and me, Gandalf, we could just talk and everything will be fine. And isn't that nice? And thankfully we have Gandalf, because the hobbits are starting to go, you know, that's a good idea. And Gandalf's
Gandalf's going to leave. it's like, yes, Saruman, you're hilarious.
He vaguely reminds me of that, where it's like, Erasmus, it's so good to see. No, I didn't hate Trevor. Oh, no. We of course had different views on things, but no. We were just interested in different. No, let's come have something to drink. I kept waiting. It's like, don't drink the what? Don't eat the pheasant. Because he's, you know, you can tell he's up to something, but you can also see why he's playing himself that way to Dr. Craven, because Craven's going to fall for it. That's his thing. Mm-hmm. So I agree. Yeah. If there's any subtlety at all in this film, it's with Boris Karloff, of all things. Yeah,
by comparison, he's incredibly subtle, because no one else is.
No.
What about Hazel Court as Lenore?
I mean, let's face it's a Corman film, so it's a woman, so she doesn't have much to do.
Yeah, she just, you know, smile and show her breasts. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, and you can even see the corset that's, you know, the magic playtex push-up bra. You know, you can see what's going on there and why he's doing what he's doing.
She does at least occasionally seem to be having some fun with it.
Yeah.
As this sort of femme fatale, but... And I like the way she adapts to things really fast when she realizes Scarabeus is lost. And it's like, oh, Erasmus, I was under a spell. It's like, okay, nice reaction, Toots, but nobody's buying it.
I am glad that Erasmus was finally had learned a little bit about human nature. It was like, no.
Yeah.
She has given so little to do. It's almost a throwaway part. It's a necessary part, but it's almost throwaway. So, how about Olive Sturgis as Estelle?
She's there.
You know, I noticed that.
Yeah, she talk about not being given anything to do. I'll come with you, Father.
Yeah.
Look out. I'm frightened.
Oh, Jack Nicholson is handsome. Kind of. I mean, back then he has
charisma. He does. He has presence. He does.
Not
he
really yet. Does. He's more like presence adjacent at this point.
Well, he grows into it.
So she's fine. Yeah, but Jack doesn't have much to do either.
No, he doesn't. At one point, he may or may not be possessed.
Yeah.
And when he starts driving the coat, yeah. which we never, it's never really said. At all, my note, it says, oh no, he's been possessed by the spirit of old Jack Nicholson. Because he starts doing Jack Nicholson's expressions.
And, yeah.
You know, the crazy-eyed look that we're so used to.
As the young, I guess, supposed hero, he does stand mm-hmm. around a lot with his mouth open.
He does look like, okay, honey, I think it's, like, do you have your helmet and your special gloves?
It's more like the sound man is like, I'll just cut out the part where he stands there going, you know, it's
Raj,
early Jack.
Do you need me for anything or what?
Yeah, I mean, we know
that. Can I get a chair?
We know Jack will get better. So it's, you know, his part is so meaningless in the film that you could forget he was there. It's fine. There's more people in this, I guess.
And the rest.
Yeah. Well, we have, the only other one might be Roderick Craven, played by Dick Johnstone, who is the body of
the corpse
of Erasmus, who, rather juicy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's, considering he's been dead for 20 years, there's kind of a lot of meat left on those bones.
Well, and they go down to get some hair of a dead man because it's part of the potion that will turn Peter Lorre Raven back into the real Dr. Raven Lorre, whatever. And he opens the casket to cut some hair out, and Dad basically wakes up and says, beware, beware. And so what is the reaction? Oh, we'll just close the lid again and walk away.
Yeah, it's like, Dad, you speak? You're alive? You're undead? What's happening?
Are you going to let him out?
That's the last we hear. It's like,
he shows up later, too. But
as an illusion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a Corman film. I will say that of the performances I've seen in the films we've watched for this series this far, I'm not going to say they're bad, but I would say that these are on the bottom of the ones we've watched. Because in general, even when it's not a known actor or a big name or anything, he seems to get a little something extra out of them. And this, I don't think he gets nearly as much as he has in some of his other films.
I get the feeling, at least with the big three, they knew what they were making and they just, they couldn't bring themselves to give a crap.
And Vincent, I think, is of the three, seems to be the most easygoing of the bunch, right? Well,
he's the one who's worked with Corman the most. Yeah. I mean, I think Karloff may have worked with him in one or two others.
Well, the Terror, apparently.
Yeah, the Terror, but I wouldn't swear to it.
Well, and here's the thing about Vincent Price. If he got the same thing he got last time, he made $100,000 off this movie. So it's like, why wouldn't he? You know, he's having fun.
For 15 days work.
And of course with Corman, you might be making 5 or 6 films a year. So if you can work with Corman and make $500,000, yeah, sure, no problem.
No kidding.
So yeah.
And of course, really, the one who walks away with this movie is Aaron Saxon as Gort.
Who was Gort?
Gort was the henchman, Scarabus's henchman.
I
kept waiting. I was like, oh, please, somebody say Klaatu Barada Nikto. Come on.
I didn't even know he had a name. So
you hear it once. I saw it in the credits.
So, yeah, we start off the film with, what's the word I want? Repeats, reruns of scenes we've seen in other Corman films.
Yeah, very familiar footage.
And of course, back then, you have to remember, films were a totally different beast. You didn't see them on TV for the most part.
No.
You didn't have a video cassette or a DVD or whatever. You were going to see it once and that was it. So if you reuse something from a year ago, most likely people were not going to remember. Because they also wouldn't have seen your film more than once. They would have seen it, maybe larfed, and then left. So it's, you know, it's fine. However, there's, I guess, Vincent trying to do the initial part of the poem. And he literally stands up, and you can hear the word bonk when he hits his head on the telescope. And my note was, we are in for a wild ride, because that's not the last time he hits his head on that telescope.
Oh,
I think it's 3 or 4. And I was like, if he runs into that one more time, I'm going to strangle Poe myself.
It's funny!
Oh, man. I also had a thought that, you know, he's pining over his dead wife, Lenore, and I couldn't help but think, you know, she might come back if he had a better painting.
Yeah, I was like, really? Did you commission that thing? God,
it's
terrible.
It's
obviously it's something that like Corman went down to Venice Beach to those guys who sit and do characters and go, hey, can you do one that's not too caricaturish? Not really. but it's $5? Yeah, here.
I mean, yeah.
It doesn't look like anybody, really.
It's meant to look vaguely like Modigliani. It doesn't. But her neck's too short for one thing. Modigliani loved his long necks, but he did do that blank eyes thing, so whatever. We lose focus a lot. I don't know if you noticed, but whenever we zoom in on the bird. Yeah.
Bit blurry. Yeah, and what did you think of that initial special effect where we see Erasmus sketching in the air with the purple lines?
I could not for the life of me figure out why he was doing it.
Well, I assume it was just like, oh, this is fun.
I mean,
except then he goes and says, yeah, I don't do magic. I haven't done magic forever.
He's basically making the logo of the movie.
Yeah, pretty much.
And when the Raven does show up, I'm sure you did notice, but it's on a string.
Yes. You can barely see that string.
Yeah, and you could tell whenever they needed the bird to fly off somebody's shoulder, somebody would yank the string and the bird would fly off and whatever.
Poop.
As for these special effects, please note, for the length of our show this week, the word special should be considered to be in quotes.
Just take that as red.
Yeah, or green or blue, whatever the colors they're casting their magic in.
When they're trying to make the potion to turn Bedlow back.
Yeah.
And first off, I'm going, why is there a tarantula in there? They don't like indoors. They like hot, dry places.
They also like to hide a lot. They don't like to come out. Somebody must have poked it with a stick.
Yeah. It's like anytime you want a scary-looking spider, you get a big, hairy one like a tarantula. Well,
also, why would anybody want to make a potion that basically creates instant lorry?
Hey, we're a magic. We're all about coulda, not shoulda. And I got to say, when he gets that box full of eyeballs, considering they've been down there just in a box for 20 years, they are remarkably squishy looking.
I was also amazed that the Raven just didn't go right after him, right? Because that's one of those birds' favorite things.
Lunch.
Yummy eyeballs.
And what sorcerer uses a whisk in his potion?
It's a magic whisk.
Oh, sure.
It's +4 versus potions. I don't know. there's jokes. I want to say that these are the kind of jokes that you would call yucks, right? Because and there's pratfalls. Like,
there's a lot of attempt at physical humor.
I mean,
there are some sequences. What was the point of the trying on the robes scene?
They're about to go well what that was for.
What?
Padding.
There is a sequence where they're about to go out into the night, and Bedlow asks if he can borrow a cloak, and they try several on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one, the whole joke is, it's too long, Price steps on it, and Peter Lorre falls down.
Ha ha. Oh.
Hold for laughs.
Well, then they go through the hats.
Yes.
And the best part is that when Peter Lorre's character finally chooses a hat, all I could think of was, that's the hat you chose?
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, there weren't a lot of great choices there, but that's it, huh? Okay.
Yeah. It's a very odd sequence.
I don't know about you, but I actually thought that Grimes was originally supposed to be played by Tor Johnson.
Time for go to bed. It would have been better casting, but they probably couldn't afford Tor after all those other salaries.
Yeah, well, I think that we can both agree the most expensive thing in the film, besides the salaries for the stars, was that one carriage scene where it's, going thundering along the coastline. All I could think of is like, wow, that's a lot of money for Corman to spend right there. That's...
Yeah, you had to rent horses. Those are real horses. It's a real coach.
Yeah, it's a real coast. I can only guess, how many films are we going to see this in? Because I'm betting that's what the deal was. One of the things I did want to bring up, and I did a little bit of research, is this time period, 1964, especially for...
Three, I'm sorry,
you're right, that's actually very important. 1963, we're doing a film about wizards and wizardry. You could stretch that out to witchcraft. This is a time period where the culture, especially pop culture, would start focusing on that. So we would get... And I checked to see who came first, and it turns out... This did, but what about Bewitched? What about the Munsters? What about the Addams Family? What about I Dream of Jeannie? Started in 64, 65. So this kind of came first. I remember a film, and we did this, I don't remember which episode number it was, mm-hmm. but we did a film called Bell, Book, and Candle, which me, at least cinematically, was kind of the first depiction of the modern witch, quote-unquote. The non-black hat, broom riding, blah, 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 the urban sort of witchcraft thing. Well, it turns out, now that was 1958. In 1961, the reason we might have started getting a lot of this stuff is there was apparently a law against practicing witchcraft.
And it was still on
the books.
Law?
Yeah, and it was still on the books, and they repealed it in 1961.
Oh, huh.
And when I looked even further, it turns out that Wicca and witchcraft, that paganism, that kind of thing, started to become a real cornerstone of the counterculture. Because it was...
Yeah. People started using tarot cards, getting into the I Ching.
Well, it was also just anti-establishment. It was not what we had before, TM. one of the things, too, about these shows like I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched and stuff is they appear to have very strong central female characters. The thing is, if you look a little deeper, you realize that those strong female characters are still just there to assure the men that they're still in charge. Because what does Samantha
they're
do?
They're very subordinate. Yes. Yeah.
Samantha's like, oh, I don't want anything I could ever want by wrinkling my nose. I just want to be a plain, ordinary housewife. Which, of course, a lot of the women who had been plain, ordinary housewives since the end of the World War II. It was big. It was all the papers.
Yes, it was, Mike. Very good.
Since then, had gone through the 50s, we're like, we don't want this now. We want more things to do. So,
well, there was stuff like they had gone into work in the factories, and they discovered they could make money, they could control more of their own destiny. They're going, hey, we want to keep doing that.
Well, in Kel Surprise, women can just be as skilled as men doing these things if you train them.
Who knew?
Apparently, still today, that's a problem, but whatever.
Yeah.
So they would have these shows, and they would take bits of the counterculture and, of course, use it for potentially their own agenda, again, to make men feel better about, you know, women becoming uppity and casting spells and stuff. This is, in a way, it's connected, because there was so much about this kind of thing going on at the time, and I wondered, where did this film fit in? And technically, it comes earlier. It's almost a year before the wizard duel in Sword in the Stone, for interest. I thought it would go the other way, and I highly doubt Roger Corman had spies at Disney.
And I don't know if Chris, this was pretty successful. I wonder if Disney knew about this movie.
Although, to be fair, the E.B. White book, do they have the wizard duel in that?
No, they don't have Madame Mim.
Ah, so there you go. So I thought he might have gotten it from the book. But yeah, you know, every once in a while, maybe our Corman can sort of presage some stuff that's going to be big coming down the road, like Jack Nicholson. And forks.
That's a point. Forks?
Yes, before this film, I don't know if you knew this, there were no forks, ever.
I had no idea. And
only because they appeared in this film did they suddenly become a thing.
Whoa.
See the things you learn on our show, and people say it's just dumb.
and knowing is half the battle.
Is that pork chop sandwiches?
No, where?
So yeah, I just.
By the way, go ahead. You notice the first magic duel, such as it is, we see is between Bedlo and Scarabus, when Bedlo uses his Promethean magic, aka sparklers.
What was that supposed to do?
I don't know. Yeah. Promethean magic, fire from the heavens.
Okay.
So I assume something was supposed to explode. And Scarabus, you know, does his little, you know, wicky-wacky-wicky with his fingers and zaps him into a puddle.
Of jam. Or
seems to, and then, yeah, that's the thing. First off, Vincent Price tastes it. And raspberry jam. And do you notice he's flipping off the camera when he does it? As he's doing it with his middle finger, he's holding it up.
Well, you know, the one thing that's often very true about human blood is there's small seeds in it. And it has a fruit.
That's the odd thing. Nobody seems... It's like, wait, it's raspberry. Does that mean they think Scarabus turned him into raspberry jam? Or everyone is remarkably calm about the fact that a guy just died in front of them, including the guy's son.
Well...
Who's just sort of like, oh.
Well, that'll happen. Well, as we know now, because of your trivia, they didn't get along, so maybe that was his ad-libbing, oh good, I'm glad he's gone, I don't know. And there's also some scenes that, where they're walking to the castle and there's a thunderstorm, it's like, yeah, you shouldn't do that because it's throwing shadows on the backdrop.
Yeah, that was a mistake. Would you, somebody stop flicking the light switch on and off?
So there's magic and then there's magic, like the magic of somebody throwing a plastic bat onto Vincent Price.
Yeah, okay, we got it. Oh, no, that goes on to Karloff.
That's Karloff, that's right. However, we did that last week, and I don't need to beep anything more.
Okay.
There's a scene where I'm guessing what Karloff has done is he's animated the gargoyles.
Yeah.
I guess.
And basically, Vincent Price is being attacked by close-ups.
Because they don't actually move. They change color, kind of.
They zoom in on one at some point, and that they sort of just show them.
And I
guess we're supposed to believe they're attacking him, and then he turns them into puppies.
Well, I guess just as the special effects people are about to ply their trade, he banishes them off the screen.
Let's talk about the wizard's duel.
Come
on.
Well, so there's this tension in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this goofy-ass music and slapstick comedy. So earlier...
The music is very strange in this.
Did you start thinking Gilligan's Island? Because I sure
yes,
did.
I did. I mean, at one point, there's a... When it looks like... Scarabus throws a spear that appears to go through Erasmus's body.
Yeah.
And you can hear a sort of goofy version of Chopin's Funeral March being played for a few bars. And for some reason, when the roof starts collapsing, they're playing Glow Little Glowworm.
Yeah. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Whoop!
Yeah.
I know that's Star Wars. That's Empire Strikes Back.
And the bit at one point, Scarabus conjures a cannon and fires it. And all I wrote there was... Ah, the great wizard Bugs Bunny has made an appearance.
Well, also, all I could think of was, oh, if only I could stand up and walk over there.
Yeah.
Because what's Karloff going to do, re-aim the cannon? He can't aim that thing.
Yeah, they don't tell you anything about the rules, or if there are rules, like, are they not allowed to get out of the chairs? Is that part of it? You know, Vincent using the power of wiring to make his chair fly. And he's literally flapping his hands like wings.
Well, at one point he goes through the floor because and he's going to die in the basement, I guess. I don't know. Is that maybe that's how you forfeit if you ever hit the basement? I don't know.
I don't know.
It's it's not as magical as one would hope. It's also not as funny as one might hope.
No, the sad thing is some of the ideas are kind of cool. I like that, Scarabus throws a snake at him and he turns the snake into a scarf. Mm. And then he bundles up the scarf and turns it into a rubber bat and throws it at Scarabus. And Scarabus turns that into a fan.
Yeah.
It's like, again, if they had spent more than $1.95 on the special effects, that actually could have been kind of fun.
Well, if they had kept to that little clever bit like you were talking about, because right after that, they just sort of start tossing spells. I mean, I guess...
Yeah, they're like zap-beaming each other.
I'm guessing they're out of first and second levels, and they're having to go to their big third and fourth level guns.
Yeah,
that's way.
Apparently, they both do prismatic spray a lot.
Well, you know, it's a pretty handy spell. Except
they can only do one color.
Or one of our friends' versions, spasmatic sphere, which was...
Yes. Yeah, that was a fun...
Thank you, Charles.
That's a deeper...
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think that was meant to be kind of the high point of the film. And
that's the
explosive
climax.
I had been high at that point of the film.
When
you pair a wizard's duel with doo doo loo doo loo doo loo, Gilligan, drop those coconuts, bark, ow! I don't know. There was just no tension left in that. But we're kind of giving stuff away, and we are nearly at that point.
You notice the stone castle catches fire?
Well, that's because it's got that roof made of wood, just like that barn.
And also, what an odd thing. This is not very Corman-esque, and it's not sort of in keeping with the type of movie. The bad guys live. They're sort of battered, but they're okay.
Yeah, okay. I think we can do better than that.
Don't ask Brad and Janet. They always lie.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, quite honestly, I'm waiting for the film to end and hear da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah, I assume it's to keep it more of a comedy, because if you think about it, nobody actually dies in this movie.
No. I guess not. They get, yeah, except Dad. And even then.
Well, yeah, but he died 20 years ago. Yeah, he's not. I'm not dead.
Ain't gonna go for a walk.
You're not fooling anyone, you know.
I feel happy. I feel happy. Oh, thank you very much. So, yeah, we should get to the thing.
We should, yeah.
The finish.
To Max.
Yeah.
After all this time, your childhood favorite, that wizard duel that just brought you so much joy and wonder, what does Roger Corman's adaptation, can I use that word?
Yeah, sure,
adaptation,
why not?
Of Poe's poem, The Raven, how does that fill your child's heart now?
I was a very stupid little boy.
Well, you know, you are what
it doesn't hold up at all. What are you kidding?
Yeah.
I get why I liked it as a kid, because what the hell else was there?
Apparently, you didn't get to see. What was that, the magic sword with Basil Rathbone? And
no, I did not get to see that.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of it before Misty showed it to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
For Jack the Giant Killer.
It's trying. I mean...
Is it?
There are some parts I smiled at. I can't say I laughed at any point. But it's lighthearted, which quite honestly, after all this, Corman is kind of a nice change.
Except that two of the other films we watched were ostensibly comedies.
Yeah, but there are comedies with actual death and murder and horrible things, and this is just silly.
Yeah, but it was 50s horrible. It wasn't really very
horrible. Yeah, I know. It wasn't bloody. But
we're not watching Seven.
It wasn't supposed to be. They were supposed to be, comedy horror. This is just supposed to be silly. This is just supposed to be a goofy comedy.
Yeah.
I can see why a kid might like... Well, I'm sorry. I can see why a kid 100 years ago might like it.
You're not that old.
But feels like it today. Now, it doesn't work. It really doesn't. And it's sad because it's a waste of some incredible people. You know, admittedly, for Peter Lorre and Boris Karloff, kind of at the ends of their careers. Mm. I mean, mostly they were going to end up doing, like, beach blanket bingo movies for a while.
Oh, dear. Yes. It's like some of the silent film stars.
Peter Lorre also died the following year.
No, everybody does eventually.
Yeah.
Vincent would last quite a lot longer.
I'm wrong. Boris doesn't die until 69.
Oh.
So he does get to appear in, I think, at least two Frankie and Annette movies.
Really?
I think so.
As which one?
Well, hey, he's good enough. He could play either one. I mean, he'd have to stuff a couple of beach balls down the front of his shirt to play Annette.
I don't want to see Boris Karloff in a bikini, please.
You know there is an entire fetish community built around that.
No, can I not give you $5 to not see that, please? I have $5. But now.
But then, of course, that's really all that's important. So let's move on. Oh, right. You're here.
I'm fired.
What about you? Now, had you ever seen this?
No, I didn't even know it existed.
I didn't think so. Yeah.
This isn't even like a, you know, WLVI TV, Channel 56 creature double feature film. Never even heard of it. And to be fair, I knew parts of the poem, The Raven by Poe, which I had to go. I actually said, you know, let's go ahead and read this. I'm sure it's not very long. It wasn't. And wow, boy, that guy's depressed. Whoo!
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's very likely he was clinically depressed. I mean.
So, hey, I had this girl and I was really, really into her and she's gone now. Think I'll ever get over that? Nope. Are you sure? Nope. What if I ask me myself, will I ever get over this? Nope. Okay, I guess I'll just sit here and nope. Because, wow, man, that is a depressing poem.
It is a grim poem.
Yeah. And has literally nothing to do with this film except there's a bird in it. That's it.
And there's a woman named Lenore.
Sure.
You know, clasp a rare and radiant maiden, the angels hath named Lenore, quote the raven, eat my shorts. Sorry, that's
eat my
from
shorts.
The
yeah, I kind of wish it was that. Yeah, no, I don't think it's funny. I mean, here's the thing. Corman probably does have a sense of humor. I think he's more of a launchpad for other people's senses of humor.
Yeah.
It's not a horror film. It's not a good magic film. It's just not a good film.
No.
And we've seen Corman do better.
No, it really isn't. Yeah.
It's also not even one of those films like last week's. I think there was a real germ of an interesting idea there, and I would love to see it changed into something a bit more. This, it's like, yeah, we can move on now. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
I am amazed it made so much money.
Well, I guess there weren't a lot of magic-type pictures out.
Well, and again, because of, you know, that little bit of research I did, apparently it was in the forefront of the counterculture. So
yeah,
maybe they felt that by going to this film, they're in a way thumbing their nose at the establishment somehow or something. I don't know, but whatever, you know. So I'm going to say, yeah, if you're a Corman fan, this was apparently one of his most highly rated films, and I don't get why. So there's other ones I would recommend over this. So I'd say give it a pass.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't give a pass is our poll question. You should, in fact, answer it. And how? What is the poll question, and how might they answer? Please tell me now. Now.
I will only tell you once you have solved these increasingly complicated riddles and puzzles.
But first, the poll question.
Right. Damn it! Which author's work do you most enjoy seeing adapted into film? Mm. And you can answer this question in a multitudinous of ways.
No, three, really.
Well, yeah. You can email us at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can go to our website, which is coincidentally maxmikemovies.com. What are the odds? And leave a comment. You can also find us on the Facings Book and in under Face Max Mike Movie.
Book. Facebook. One word. Facebook. That's it.
I'll get it in another 300 episodes or so.
You're going to get it in less than that.
And, of course, you can always find us on the podcast app of your choosing, our choosing, or possibly Vincent Price's choosing.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not done, not by a long shank.
No, we've got
more Corman coming up. Yeah. What's coming up next, Mike?
Max, you know, I thought it's about time. You and I never seem to get away, so I thought you and I are going to take a little trip.
Take a little trip. Take a little trip with me. Oh. We're going out on our lowriders?
In a manner of speaking, we might. Because I honestly don't know what's in this film, except it was based on an actual experience that Roger Corman had.
And making a bad movie?
You know, I kind of wish he had. That might have been fun. We could have turned it into a musical.
That actually would have been cool.
Yeah. No, as it turns out, so one of the things you mentioned earlier was that Hazel Court remembered Jack Nicholson leaving the set a lot saying, I have to write, I have to write. Well, this is going to be one of those things that he wrote.
Oh.
This is a screenplay by one Mr. Jack Nicholson.
Oh, my.
And it's called The Trip. And it is a film about...
Oh, it's a travelogue.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, nice. So where are they? Like, go down to Mexico or maybe over to the Sandwich Islands? Or
Mexico could have something to do with it. I'm not entirely sure. But, Max, what if you could take a trip entirely inside your own head, man?
Whoa, you just blew my mind, Humphrey.
Well, and that's what Corman's looking to do in The Trip, because it is about LSD, something that was also, how to put this, quite popular at the time.
Lakeside day tripping?
Lysergic acid diethylamide, but
that's
beyond, yeah. You should be happy I know what that is. I learned it from Dragnet, the opposite of next week's movie. So if you want to see the opposite of Dragnet, join us next week when we take... A trip with The Trip.
Far out, man.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.